words we live by. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the second in this series of 15 literary dialogues on love, human and divine, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Professor Mark Van Doren.
Mark, last week we spoke in this series on God's love of man, and we could continue on that, of course, for a long time. But we must move on and look at another aspect, the converse, man's love of God, and what it means, its interpretation in actual life. To me, it's always been a deeply puzzling subject, perhaps to begin with because the command is given in the Hebrew Bible over and over again, especially in Deuteronomy, but it occurs in other passages in Joshua, elsewhere. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God. In some place, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. And I don't know how to reconcile that with love. The command to love, the more puzzling to me because it is a fundamental law, but it doesn't occur like another law that we shall talk about later, of man loving his fellow man. It doesn't occur in the Ten Commandments, and yet it is one of the most basic laws.
Oh, yes, by all means. We come across it not only half a dozen times, we come across it 100 times. Man's duty is to love God. Man must love God. I'm not sure that I'm so puzzled by this in view of the matter that we mentioned last week, Maurice, when we spoke of the fact that God was invisible. God, of course, is a person in the Hebrew Bible. He is a person as God has never been, as no other God has ever been. He is a person who feels as well as thinks, who hopes and regrets and plans and is dejected and is afflicted, as I remember you pointed out. He is a person. But he is up there. He is away. He is out of sight. He has appeared only through fire and flame, or he has appeared only as a voice, and then, most rarely. So that the command to love him would be something like the command to remember something that is very hard to remember because the senses do not assist. It wouldn't be enough, of course, to point out at this time how frequently the people in the Hebrew Bible are asked to keep his commandments, to remember his law.
Now, well, that is easy to understand. That is why I suppose the Ten Commandments, here you're told what to do, and it's within your power to do so, to honor your father and mother, not to lie, not to kill, but to tell someone, thou shalt love the Lord thy God. There is a counsel of perfection, almost an impossibilism. Well, I suppose, nevertheless, it has to be said. The remark that you made a moment ago regarding the difference between, say, the pagan attitude toward the gods and the Jewish, the loving of God, I don't remember in what I've read of pagan literature the feeling that one is close to, beloved by Jupiter or by Apollo. One can have one of the gods as one's patron saint, as it were. But in the sense of the passages I quoted last week, that God takes care of the little man and worries about him, that isn't there. Nor have you got the feeling of occasional the father love, which is often expressed in these anthropomorphic and intimate terms. They hadn't it. And one of the reasons that The Jews used the name Epicurus as an indication of atheism was that the Epicureans held that there were gods and they ought to be worshipped, but they're not interested in the destiny of man. And it's funny how that word, an Epicurus, now used in plain Yiddish, means an unbeliever.
Yes,
now, the Epicurean wasn't an unbeliever. He merely thought the gods didn't care about the human beings.
That's right, and Lucretius, in his great poem concerning the nature of things, as a matter of fact, a poem which attacked religion, but attacked it only as something that, in Lucretius's mind, afflicted men and made them miserable. Lucretius said, of course there are gods, but they live up in a niche in the universe. They live in a place where there's no rain, no hail, no snow, no cold, no hot. And they enjoy themselves up there, utterly cut off from men. And they do not even hear the prayers of men. They're not interested in them. But I'm interested, too, in your remark about the difference between all others' view of God and the view of God that is in the Hebrew Bible. I think I once heard you say that you could hardly conceive of a Roman saying, Jupiter loves me.
Yes.
Just as you cannot imagine, even in Plato, who in his Symposium and elsewhere is so singularly moving and powerful about love and about desire, even Plato assumes, or Socrates assumes, that the object of love, which had better be abstract. That is to say, you'd better not fasten your love upon perishable things, upon food, of course, or drink, or upon persons, men or women. But you must love that object which will never cease to be there, that object in which, as Dante says, the mind or the intellect can rest.
Well, there's a...
But it can, that's the point. The mind can rest, the intellect can rest in that object, which will continue to have its own purposes and to be somehow or other separate from us. It is something that we must go to and love, rather than something that comes to us and makes us love it.
Well, there's a passage in Seneca in which he says that to consider that the gods can occupy themselves with the tawdry and sordid and filthy concerns of mankind is a downright blasphemy.
Yes.
So that this remoteness, which Hebrew Bible destroyed for the world, bringing in this intimacy, one might imagine that, look, we've done this for you. In return, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy might, with all thy soul, with all thy heart. And yet, I say, there is this difficulty. And for that reason, I suppose, there have always been... Well, in all great religions, there are various schools. But you will find in the Jewish tradition, there are two approaches to God, not exclusive, but two points of vantage. One is the knowledge of God, and the other is the love of God. You can think of the rationalists as those that cultivated the knowledge of God, and you think of the mystics as those who cultivated the love of God. If you bring it down to modern times, you might adduce as examples, there's a very wonderful story by Peretz about between two cliffs of a young man who was caught between two mighty spirits. One was the Rabbi of Brisk, a tremendous intellect and a severe student, and the other was the Hasidic Rabbi Noachke, who was full of tenderness and kindliness and saw God almost exclusively under the aspect of the love of one's father. And between these two, he felt himself trapped. He didn't know which of the two was stronger, although he was himself a follower of Reb Noachke. This difference between knowledge of God and love of him, Pascal has a remark, that the knowledge of God is very far from the love of God. And I suppose one can see this illustrated in the fact that one doesn't think of philosophers primarily as lovers of God. Do you think of Spinoza, in spite of his phrase, the intellectual love of God, and they talk about him as a God-drunken man? I can't think of him as loving God in the sense that a simple loving person does. You know, there's a story told about Spinoza and Voltaire. Voltaire figures Spinoza walking about in his room late one night, then looking up at heaven and saying to God, entre nous, je ne crois pas que vous existez. Between you and me, I don't think you exist.
Yeah.
Now,
And yet he was speaking to him.
Yeah, he was speaking to him.
Well, now, Maurice, I'm not willing to let go quite so easily the notion that the love of God is a different, an altogether different thing from the knowledge of him. I know you are not either, but when you speak of certain kinds of knowledge of God, the kind that Spinoza said he had when he said he had an intellectual love of God, or when we think of Socrates' love of ideas, or the truth, the love of all there is, or when we think of any philosopher's statement that for him to say that he loves the truth is merely to say that he asserts its existence and is willing to accept the truth as his only...
Also willing to suffer for it.
Yes, that's right. We're talking about a very special kind of man. I quite agree with you that at the opposite end of the human scale, there can be a person of the utmost simplicity, without any intellectual equipment at all, so far as we can tell, without any training in philosophy or without any ostensible logic or metaphysic in his makeup, or her makeup, because it can be might be an old woman or a young woman. At the opposite end of the human scale, there can be the person who, of whom we can say that he or she loves God, although there is no knowledge there that a philosopher would recognize. And that only, for me, is a reminder of the very deep connection there is between love and knowledge. I'm not sure that we can love anything or know anything without loving it. Maybe the philosopher starts at the wrong end by trying to prove that God exists and by trying to prove that this would be the knowledge of him if he did, and therefore we might love him. He might begin at the other end of love itself and try to explain it. You know, you remember, you spoke of Lamb the other day, Charles Lamb. He once said, you remember, that he didn't want to meet a certain man whom he didn't like by reputation. And,
yes.
And he said, I don't want to meet him because I'm sure I would like him.
Well,
I would get acquainted with him and like him.
That's that old story of the Irishman who said that I don't like bananas and I'm glad I don't like them because if I liked them, I'd eat them and I don't like them.
That's right. And, of course, Mark Twain turned this very adroitly once. Because he was insisting that he was never going to cease to hate someone. He said, I would like to meet that man, get thoroughly acquainted with him, and kill him. Which, of course, would be humanly almost impossible.
Yes.
Because I quite agree with
that.
Well,
the way he put it obviously wasn't serious.
That's right.
But let me get back to something that I've often thought about. And that is that people who mistake a kind of liking for God for love of God.
That's a nice distinction.
It's a queer attitude that some people have. You know, isn't there a song like that or a saying, somebody up there likes me?
Yeah.
I think it's a terribly trivial observation. The notion that God is a very good-natured sort of a person and he's all right, not aware of the passion of concern which such love would imply, but, oh, he'll do things for me. You remember that passage in Omar Khayyam? Folks of a surly tapster tell and daub his visage with the smoke of hell. They talk of some strict testing of us. Pish. He's a good fellow and it'll all be well. Hmm. But I think that's silly.
Of course.
It's not love of God at all. It's a feeling that you're going to be just given all the breaks and not questioned too carefully as to what you've done with them.
Nevertheless, Maurice, in so saying, you are admitting, it seems to me, that the God that one loves and is commanded to love and must love if one is to be happy at all, that God is in some sense still remote. Only in this sense, I think. We are commanded to love him even though he may not do us favors. Even though it may seem in our lives that he is not interfering in our favor. Because the love of God that we are commanded to have, as I understand it in the Hebrew Bible, is a love of God that is for which no payment is expected.
Yes, now, isn't that odd? That same Spinoza that I just felt, and have often felt to be a very chilly sort of man, has a penetrating remark in connection with what you've just said. But he who loves God cannot endeavor to bring it about that God should love him. Mm. It is a completely disinterested love. You know, among Jews, there is the tradition of the utterly selfless man who goes so far in his love of another man. We're going to talk about man's love for men next week. But it goes so far in his love of another man, he says, I'll sell you my portion in paradise. I'll give you my portion in paradise. I'll forfeit my life to come for this and this for you. Reminds me, by the way, of that very fine movie, I hope you've seen it, Graham Greene, of the priest who gives away to save a beloved one's life, gives away his faith.
Yeah.
He said, God, take away from me the thing I love most.
That's right.
I need most. And here in the Jewish tradition, there's a story of the man who will give away his life to come to prove that he serves God entirely without any motive of self.
Well, now, that's why, Maurice, I want to keep harping, if I seem to do so, upon the obligation to love. It is difficult to love God in this way. For Spinoza, who was, of course, a pure philosopher, it was difficult to come to the point where one could love God regardless, as you say, without expecting love in return. And even in the human sphere, isn't it true that surely we could not be said to love somebody only because that person loved us? The loves of men and for men and men for women are most impressive when they seem to have no strings on them. And there are many, many cases where A loves B without any clear evidence that B returns the love, but A loves B in any case. So the love of God is a difficult thing and perhaps therefore must be commanded. Let me ask you once more, if there's too much difference, I know there is a great difference, but if there's a categorical difference between loving God and loving the law, you remember not only in Proverbs, but in the Psalms and in many of the poetical portions of the Bible, suddenly the speaker says, I love the law.
I love thy Torah, yes.
How lovely is the law.
Yes.
And there's even a sensual...
How lovely are thy tabernacles, meaning, of course, the way of living in God.
Now there, you see, the thing that is loved is at least abstract, because law, by definition, is abstract. Law is not for individuals,
well,
it's law is for all.
That might also include the statement, since it is the law that thou shalt love God... Then there's a very deep complication there. The notion of loving God, and even if he doesn't love me, is a very difficult one. For me, one of the loveliest expressions of a man's feeling for God lies actually in the father image. It's customary now, it's fashionable now, to speak with de haut en bas, you know, looking down one's nose at the father image. It's been spoiled by the psychoanalysts. In fact, any kind of liking for one's father is already a sign of some kind of inward psychological corruption. I don't know what they're driving at.
Yeah.
There's a very beautiful poem of Coventry Patmore's. People don't read him anymore. The toy...
By the way, that doesn't make any difference. That's all the more reason why we should talk about him. I speak as a poet, you know.
Yes, well, but you haven't reached the classic stage yet where you aren't read.
Oh, maybe I have. Well, go ahead. You had, I'd like to hear this.
This one, he said, my little son who looked from thoughtful eyes and moved and spoke in quiet grown-up wise, having my law the seventh time disobeyed, I struck him and dismissed with harsh words and unkissed his mother, who was patient, being dead. Then, fearing lest his grief should hinder sleep, I visited his bed, but found him slumbering deep, with darkened eyelids, and their lashes yet from his late sobbing wet. And I, with moan, kissing away his tears, left others of my own. For on a table drawn beside his head, he had put within his reach a box of counters and a red-veined stone, a piece of glass abraded by the beach, and six or seven shells, a bottle with bluebells, and two French copper coins arranged there with careful art to comfort his sad heart. So when that night I prayed to God, I wept and said, ah, when at last we lie with trancèd breath, not vexing thee in death, and thou rememberest of what toys we made our joys, how weakly understood thy great commanded good, then, fatherly, not less than I, whom thou hast molded from the clay, thou wilt leave thy wrath and say, I will be sorry for their childishness. It's a very beautiful thing.
Yes.
And I am averse to the attitude which doesn't permit us for, what shall I say, for self-expression, even though we know its limitations, this kind of anthropomorphism. When we say, our Father in heaven, or Vinusha Bashomayim, the Hebrew phrase, it is a permissible thing. We have no way of handling this relationship, this enormous abstract relationship, which nevertheless floods us with feeling. We have no way of handling it, just as the poet has no way of handling things except through words, and the sculptor except through stone.
Well, Maurice, far from disagreeing with you, I would say that the unspeakable distinction of the Hebrew Bible is that it makes God a person, is that it is anthropomorphic. The habit of dismissing things under that term, anthropomorphism, doesn't bother me at all these days. The reason that this God lived and lives is that he is a person. And as a matter of fact, I think he is lost only when we forget that, only when we begin to think of him as the truth. Merely the truth. Merely all the truth that you can find with science and everything else.
Well, returning to that distinction, Mark, between liking and love, most human beings, it occurs to me, want God to like them, not to love them. Mm. I think I mentioned last week the burden of God's love and the responsibility which it throws on us. They want to be liked by him. He should say, yes, so-and-so, he's a good chap, and I'll do this and that for him. It is this trivialization of the concept that troubles me.
Well, that's true. I quite agree. I'm reminded, however, of something that every now and then one hears. A man says of his wife, I not only love her, I like her.
Yes.
Now, that does add a little dimension, does it not?
Yes, when it's put on as a nuance, an additional tonality.
Yes.
But people would like to have a... Well, I remember that the Romans had a formal relationship to their gods. It was a social relationship. We talked before about the absence of a real human passion between the two. They went to their services and they did what was meet. That was a favorite phrase of theirs. Meet adoration to the household gods is the phrase that Tennyson uses about it. Not at all this, especially in, must be elsewhere too, but I think of the Jews. They have such intimate phrases for God. They say, gotten you, tatten you, God, Father, little Father, darling, beloved one. They really feel an intimacy, even when they quarrel with him. That's one of the beautiful things in Shalom Aleichem's description of Tevye the dairyman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He argues with God and tells him, look, you didn't do right, like a kid crying for the father, you know, Daddy, you didn't do right by me, and you should have done this, and you should have done that. And nevertheless, he loves him and worships him. You know, there's a story of 10 rabbis who once put God on trial. The head of the court was a famous Hasidic rabbi, the grandfather, they called him. And they had a trial, and 10 rabbis assembled. They didn't happen to call in God because he's everywhere. And they tried him on count of having made the Jewish people suffer too much. Not only they tried him, but they found him guilty.
Yes.
And I don't know if it made any difference to their faith or to the faith of the Jewish people. But this sort of intimacy expressing itself in such a close, almost flesh relations.
Well, you know, your distinction between loving and liking keeps haunting me. I suppose you're aware that a very powerful orator of our days, Martin Luther King, keeps saying to his fellow Negroes in the United States, you must love the white man. He said, I do not expect you ever to like him, but you must learn to love him. I remember hearing Martin Luther King once at Fisk University in Nashville say that to a congregation of Negroes in the chapel of that university. He said, I think I shall never like Senator Eastland of Mississippi, but I must learn to love him. Now,
important and decisive
now that is anticipating, I dare say, various things that we shall want to say next week when we'll talk about man's love for man. But it is only to suggest that any true discussion of man's love of man must have in its background and its source, conceptions, powerful conceptions of God's love of man and man's love of God.
Mark, can you ever conceive of love of God being of such a character that it justifies a man withdrawing from the world in order to contemplate him and be alone with him and to have nothing to do with other human beings because everything else is trivial and even repulsive by comparison?
No.
That streak appears in all religions, appeared in the Jewish too,
yes.
Although it is a deviant. And yet it has appeared. We've had, for example, the Essenes of old were those who withdrew from the world, essentially. The Rechabites before them, spoken already of in the Tanakh, in the Hebrew Bible. And in the modern world, there have been among the Hasidim that we've often spoken about. In the Hasidic world, there were rabbis who went in for what they called itbodedut, solitude, away from the madding throng, away from the pressure of human affairs. It's a deviation in the Jewish tradition, but it has been there, and I suppose will recur again and again.
Well, I think it is.
Is that a true love of God?
No, I should say not. I would call it a deviation. I would call it perhaps merely the carrying out to a logical conclusion one portion of the idea. One portion of the idea is that man should love God with all of his heart and with all of his soul and with all of his might, as if that might take all. It might take all that he had to do this. But I'm sure the original emphasis and the emphasis that persists and should persist is an emphasis that does not remove man any more than it removes God.
Well, I think
man in the world remains in the world.
Yes, it'll become up the question next week of man. Man's love for man and whether that is really not a form of man's love for God.
The trouble, Maurice, with the man who leaves the world in order to love God without interruption and without contamination, the only trouble is that he may begin to love an image of his own mind. He may begin to love hallucinations and illusions. He may begin to love symbols that with a kind of intellectual and spiritual pride he fabricates out of his own fancy, purely. Don't you think that's the trouble?
Yes, you become, you mirror yourself in God all the time.
And you become fanatic.
You become fanatical and self-centered. There's a great Jewish moralist, Bachia ben Pakuda, who lived many hundred years ago in Spain, who does speak about those that love God and how, to quote a phrase of his, in the business of the world, they are silent. He doesn't go on to recommend withdrawal from the world, but he does recognize a certain turning away from the world, which puzzles me. And I suppose when next week we begin to talk about man's love of man, we shall have to consider to what extent these two, love of God and love of man, intermingle and are necessary to each other.
Just heard The Words We Live By, the second in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Professor Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of love, human and divine. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
Next, monitor news on the hour on NBC Radio.